Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This episode contains descriptions of violence and some salty language. Listener discretion is advised. In 2011, Joe Lazito lived with his wife Andrea and two sons, Dominic and Joseph, in Philadelphia. But Joe commuted to work at Lincoln Center in New York City, where he worked in the box office.
The commute sucked, I'm not going to lie. And you know, one of the things I regret to this day is I missed a lot of things, you know, working up in New York. But at the time, financially, it was the best thing for the family.
And how long was that commute?
5 hours round trip. From the time I left my house to the time I would get to work, it was 2.5 hours each way.
What did you do?
I would buy the Philadelphia Daily News, I would buy the New York Post, and I would read that, you know, pretty much cover to cover.
On the morning of Saturday, February 12th, Joe had completed the drive to the train station, taken the New Jersey Transit train to Penn Station, and now just had to take the subway uptown.
But that day, they were doing construction on those tracks, so everything was running express.
Without digging into the weeds of the Manhattan Transit Authority's train schedules and stops, this basically meant Joe was taking a different train than he normally would.
The 3 train pulled up, so I jumped on that one. And before the doors closed, 2 cops got on, uniformed cops. They got on the train. Now I'm in the very front of the train.
How many people were in that car?
Maybe 20. It wasn't full. This was Saturday morning. So I guess you had some people that had been out from the night before, and then you had some people that were starting their weekend in New York. So maybe 20 or so people were on the car with me. Where I'm sitting is basically, there's me, there's a steel wall here, and then on the other side of the wall is the guy driving the train. So I'm literally at the very front of the train. The cops get on the train, they go right into he's called the motorman. You go right into the motorman's compartment with the guy driving the train, which is weird because I've been on the train a lot with police officers, and most of the time they just stay in the middle. You know, they're watching what's going on, or they're going station to station. So it was a little weird, but I didn't really think much of it. But then we don't move right away. And then we start moving and we're going very slowly.
But then a man approached the door the police officers had gone through and started banging on it.
And he says, "Let me in." And the voice on the other side of the door goes, "Who are you?" And he goes, "I'm the police." And they go, "You're not the police." And with that, he just turns around and he goes and sits down. Now, when he sits down, there was a woman that he sat next to, and she got up as fast, like he hadn't even hit the seat yet. And she got up and went to the other end of the car. It gets weirder because as that guy sits down, there was a gentleman standing to my left. He bolts to the door and he's tapping on the window, looking over his shoulder and tapping on the window, trying to get the cops to come out. And he looks terrified. And the first guy starts walking back up. And with that, the second guy who was tapping on the window hightails it right back to me, right next to me. And like I said, now at this point, I'm like, what the fuck is going on, right? So the first guy, he's walking towards the door. He stops about 3 feet from the door, about 2 feet from me. He looks down and he says, "You're going to die. You're going to die." He reaches into the back of his jacket, takes out an 8-inch knife, and he just whop. Right into my face right here.
This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul.
So now we're into it. So now he goes back again. He brings his arm back to come back down. And when he does that, I shoot in for his legs. But obviously, at this point, I'm just trying to get him down. And instead of hitting him in the legs, I kind of went in too high and I ended up wrapping my arms around his waist almost like a football tackle. I did get him down, but while I was taking him down, he kind of had the whole, my whole head. And that's where he kind of sliced me and stabbed me in the head here, here, and here. If I basically knew that I could die, I mean, I'm going hand-to-hand combat and he has a knife and I have nothing. But if I don't do anything, he's going to murder me. And then I'm never going to see my family again. And that wasn't an option. If I was going to die, I was going to die fighting. So I'm on top of him. And he, it's not even phasing him. Like he's so high that I don't even think he blinked. Like he's just like a robot at this point. Now he still has the knife. Throughout this whole thing, he never let go of the knife. So he's on his back and he's like flailing up with his hand. He's right-handed. So as he's trying to stab me, I'm trying to catch with my left hand, and he tried twice. Both times I missed. The first time he sliced me in my thumb in the webbing here. And the second time he got me in the tricep. And finally, the third time I was able to grab his wrist. I slammed it down on the thing. He dropped the knife. So now I'm on top of him. Then I get the tap on the shoulder from the police, who at some point finally decided to make their way out. So I get the tap on the shoulder. You can get up now. We got him. And I'm just like, okay, because now I've lost some blood and I know they have him. Two cops come out, so they got him, and I get up and I just go and sit on the subway seat. And the male officer, Terrence Howell, he's bigger than I am, and he's having a hard time trying to restrain this guy. He can't control this guy's arms. And the female cop, Tamara Taylor, couldn't have been more useless. She's just standing there and she won't get down. And she's like, should I mace him? Should I mace him? And Howell says, no, if you mace him, it's going to stay in the car. There's no ventilation. So finally, a man named Alfred Douglas, who's my hero that day, he's a construction worker. And he goes over and he helps control this guy so they can restrain him. At some point during the melee, someone pulls the emergency brake. So we stop moving, but now we're in the middle of the tunnel. We're in between Penn Station and 42nd Street in the tunnel, and we're not moving. So I'm sitting down and I have my head down, and the blood is just pouring from both sides of me. And what I always tell people is, if you want to know what that was like, next time you take a shower, turn your back to the shower head, have the water hit you in the where your neck meets your shoulders, and the water that flows down, that's basically what the blood was doing to me that day. Okay. So I'm starting to get nervous. All of a sudden, I look to my right and there's cops coming from the back of the subway. Now there's maybe 8 to 10 cops that are on there, and they're all going towards this guy.
Not only is the train not moving, but no one, including the police, is paying Joe any attention. All of the passengers have moved to the other end of the car, and Joe is just sitting there by himself, bleeding.
And a cop walks by, and I don't even lift up my head, but I kind of grab their sleeve. And I'm like, you got to get me off this train. You know, I said, you married? And they said, yeah. I said, I'm married too. I said, I want to see my wife. You got to get me off this train. Yeah, don't worry. We're working on it. Don't worry. Okay. So now a couple of more minutes go by. Still sitting there. Still, nobody's paying any attention to me. Cop tries to walk by, grab, hey, do you have kids? Yeah, I have kids. I'm like, I have two little boys. I said, I can't die on this train. You know, I'm basically beside myself. And they go, did you see how we all came from the back of the train? And I said, yes. They go, the paramedics are on their way. That's how they're going to come. So keep an eye out for the paramedic. So in my head, I'm like, all right, well, I'm getting some, you know, assistance, right?
And what are the cops doing?
I don't know. Like at this point, Gelman is apprehended, couldn't go anywhere if he wanted to. They're just all hanging out by him. So the person that I mentioned, Alfred Douglas, the guy who helped the cops corral him, He comes over and he starts basically yelling at the other passengers who are just looking at me. You guys aren't helping this guy. You're ready to watch this guy die in front of you. How come nobody's helping, right? And he, what Alfred did was, he took his hand, bare hand, and he put it up on my deepest wound, which is back here. This wound was so deep that I saw a picture of it, and you could see part of my skull. Alfred doesn't know me from anything. All he knows is he sees a guy that's possibly going to die, and he tried to help me. And then a woman came and gave him some napkins, which, of course, was a nice gesture on her part, but they're going to get soaked right away before he probably even put it down. And then he's standing there, and he's trying to keep me calm. And finally, the train starts moving.
And how long had you been sitting there?
20 minutes. 20 minutes, maybe. My life bleeding. I'm just bleeding like crazy. So we get to 42nd Street. They open the door. Now, they had cleared the station, so there was nobody on that platform except for the paramedics. So they open the door, and they get him off the train. And then the paramedics come on. They lift me off the subway seat, put me on the stretcher. And as they put me on the stretcher, I pass out. But I'm not unconscious because I can still hear everything that's going on. It's kind of like you're watching television, you're starting to nod off. And before you nod off completely, you're half in, half out. You know, you can hear what's going on around you, but you're not completely out.
Right.
Tamara Taylor, the cop behind me, was talking to one of the other cops. And in the conversation, she called me likely, which didn't register with me at all at that point. I didn't know what it meant. And up until this point, I hadn't felt any pain because I guess it was all the adrenaline. There was no pain. And even when he was stabbing me, I didn't feel, I felt like pressure. I was out maybe 10 seconds. When I came to, that's the first time I felt pain. I guess that was the adrenaline dump. And I've said it a million times, it's kind of like someone just doused my head in gasoline and lit it on fire. Like it was a pain I can't even describe. I'm on the stretcher, I'm awake now, I'm wide awake. The two paramedics were unbelievable. Those guys, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Alfred saved my life that day. The paramedics saved my life that day. I'm like, do you have anything for the pain? You know, you got anything for the pain? And I remember at this point, one of the guys said, well, we can't keep anything in the ambulance for pain because it'll probably get stolen. And I said, yeah, you know what? I guess that makes sense. But I just kept saying, just talk to me, keep me awake, because I don't know. I just know what I see on TV and in the movies. I don't want to go to sleep. I don't know if I wake up if I go to sleep.
Luckily, the Saturday morning traffic wasn't too bad. They got to the hospital quickly and immediately pumped him full of morphine.
And then a cop comes to the head of the bed, or platform, whatever it was at this point, and he shows me a mugshot. And he says, is this the guy that did this to you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you're a hero. And I said, well, I'm not a hero. Well, what did I do? Why am I a hero? And he says, well, he killed four people last night.
The man who attacked Joe was Maxim Gelman, a 24-year-old man who lived in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. The morning before attacking Joe, Gelman had stabbed his stepfather, Alexander Kuznetsov, to death over an argument about borrowing the car. Leaving his mother unharmed, Gelman took the car and drove to the home Yelena Bolchenko shared with her mother. Maxim and Yelena never dated, but he had been fixated on her since they briefly became friendly the year prior. Yelena wasn't home, but her mother, Anna Bolchenko, was. Gelman stabbed Anna to death and waited 6 hours for Yelena to come home, and when she did, he killed her too. Around 4:15 p.m., as he was speeding away from the Bolchenko home, he got out, stabbed Arthur, and stole his Pontiac Bonneville. Arthur survived, but as Gelman left that scene, he hit Steven Tannenbaum with the car, killing him. Around 12:55 a.m., Gelman forced his way into Fitz Fullerton's livery cab, stabbed Fitz, and stole the cab. Minutes later, Gelman did the same thing to Sheldon Pottinger. Around 8:30 a.m., Gelman was spotted on the one train going downtown from 137th Street. Police were alerted that Gelman was in the subway and were actively searching for him, including the two officers that boarded Joe's train and ignored Gelman when he banged on the window.
And I always say that's the part of the movie where they kind of focus on my face and then fade out in slow motion, because I still don't know how to react to that. At the time, it didn't register right away. And even talking to you today, I still don't know how to react to that, because you kind of think about your life and things that you're going to experience. You don't really ever think you're going to hear something like that. I know at one point I said to myself, well, he said I was going to die, and he really was going to try to make it happen.
While Joe's wounds were being attended to, he needed to alert his family before the attack hit the news.
And at the time, my wife was working at a health club, and on the weekend she did their books. So she's working with money. And I've called her before while she's doing the money, and it's always the same thing. I called her and I said, hey, and she's like, hey, Joe, I can't stay on the phone. I got all this money in front of me. I'll call you back when I'm done. I'm like, oh, hold on. So I said, there was an incident on the train. I said, I'm okay, but I'm in Bellevue Hospital right now. And she goes, come on, Joe, stop screwing around. You know, because I think I have the typical guy sense of humor, you know, and we had been together a while then. So I don't think I'm that twisted, but I could see, like, if she's focused on the money, like, she's like, come on, I don't have time for this. So then I took the dramatic pause and I said, Andrea, there was an incident on the train today. I am okay, but I am in Bellevue Hospital. And at that point, I felt the life just leave her body, even though I couldn't see. I just could feel it through the phone. And I hate, this is like, talking about my conversations with my wife are the toughest part of this whole story. And I just, all of a sudden, she starts screaming. And her coworker picks up the phone, and I'm like, okay, I said, this is the reaction I expected.
Andrea grabbed the boys and immediately started driving to the hospital. With his wife and kids on the way, Joe could turn his focus to the doctors addressing his wounds.
So the one doctor who was going to put me back together again, he goes, listen, he goes, I know you've been through a lot this morning. And he goes, but I have to numb your head. And he goes, this is going to suck. Because they had to basically inject it into the wound so we would numb it. He wasn't lying. It sucked. The flip side of that is, after it was numb, they could have hit me with a sledgehammer. I wouldn't have felt it. He goes, have you ever had staples? And I said, no. He goes, all right. He goes, you're going to have, just so you know, your wounds on your head, you're going to need stitches and staples. I didn't think I had any negotiating power on my side. Like, no.
Just leave it open.
yeah. Just leave it open. We'll just use Gorilla Glue on there. We'll glue it together. And then it was an interesting dynamic when the staples go in, because if anyone's ever used a staple gun, you hear like, and that's basically what it felt like. And it didn't feel like anything. Like, I felt the pressure, and it was the sound more than anything, right?
And just being aware of what it is.
Yeah. And listen, I think, you know, it was, I don't want to say it was cool, but I'm glad I was awake for it, because it was just interesting. Like, I hope I never have to go through it again. The once was enough.
How do you get staples out?
There's a little utensil, sort of, I'm sure it's a little more advanced than a staple remover, you know, like the thing, staple remover.
Uh-huh.
How you would take out staples, like if you stapled a poster to your wall as a kid and now you needed to take the staple out of the wall, you have the staple remover, you click it and you pull it out. So that's exactly how you take out staples.
Okay.
Well. So, yeah. I mean, and the good part is at that point, it's healed about as much as it's going to heal. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you even really feel it. You feel them coming out, but it's not painful.
A lot of Joe's family lived on Long Island, and they started streaming in. But the people Joe wanted to see the most were Andrea and his boys.
obviously they're coming from Philadelphia, and so they're the last ones that get there. And I think part of the reason why I get emotional is because my wife will tell you how she dealt with it and how she was able to drive up, not knowing what she's going into, is that my sons, who were 10 and 7 at the time, were basically the ones calming her down. So for me as a dad, like I'm so proud of them. Like with everything, I can't imagine what I would have done at that age if I was 10 or if I was 7 and my mother was in that situation, because you don't know. So finally I heard them before they opened the curtain. And thankfully, when you see my face, the only thing you really saw was this eye was all busted up. Like I had the stitches here and my eye was blue and yellow and red and all that stuff. But everything else was pretty much behind or on other parts of my body. So when they opened the curtain and I just saw their faces and I lost it. I lost it. So, you know, they come over, they give you the big hug, you know, and then everything was fine.
Among the many relatives that showed up for Joe that day was his sister, Angela, an NYPD cop.
And she's like, what, you know, like, what the hell, what the fuck happened, right? So I'm telling her, and then I go, I said, hey, I heard the cop say something that I don't know what it meant. She goes, what? And I go, I heard her call me likely. The color just drained from her face. And she never calls me Joseph. She calls me Joe. Everyone calls me Joe. She goes, Joseph, what did you say? And I said, yeah, she's talking to another cop and she said I was likely. And she goes, oh, likely means likely to die. And I was like, okay. So I think it was at that point where I, you know, put two and two together. Like I said, there really wasn't much concern for me on the train. I'm so grateful for someone like Alfred, because it shouldn't have been Alfred that came over to try to render any sort of medical assistance.
Yeah.
I'm forever grateful that he was there. And then her calling me likely is where I definitely knew that they had prioritized me as a very low priority, because he had already killed 4 people. If he kills 5, but they arrested him, who cares? Like, I care, my family cares. But from their point of view, they just arrested a guy that was terrorizing Brooklyn for the last 28 hours.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
But Joe did make it out alive. And the story of the subway hero that helped stop the madman who terrorized Brooklyn was all over the news.
My wife and I are watching TV, and they did like the teaser before the 5 o'clock news coming up at 5. And they say, hear from Mayor Michael Bloomberg about the apprehension of Maxim Gelman. Of course, it's the first story, and the mayor gets up there and he says, thanks to the heroic action of NYPD officers Terrence Howell and Tamara Taylor and off-duty police officer Marcelo Razzo, Maxim Gelman was apprehended on the Uptown number 3 train today. And my wife is red. And like, I sort of don't know what to say. I'm like, I know I did something. I'm in the hospital. I said, yeah, I, you know, like I'm saying that tongue in cheek, right? I don't want anyone to think, you know, but, oh, man, the steam coming out of my wife's ears. Well, okay. So that was the first I heard of it. But again, it's a quick clip. It's stable. I don't know. They didn't obviously show the whole press conference, so I don't know what is said.
Joe gave the city and the NYPD the benefit of the doubt. But that went away when he was visited by a reporter from the Daily News.
The Sunday morning, The reporter from the Daily News thinks all she's coming in to get is my reaction to how heroic the police were. So she says, could you just take me through what happened? And I said, yeah. So I start telling her the story like I was telling you. And I'm talking. And she goes, wait, well, hold on. Excuse me. I don't mean to interrupt you. She goes, you're the one that stopped him? And I said, yeah. She goes, well, that's not what the police are saying. So I go, I don't know what they're saying. I said, but this is what happened. And I would say her eyes lit up. And she goes, have you spoken to anyone else yet? And I said, no, you're the first one. And she goes, here. And she had the copy of the Daily News that day, a copy of the Post and the Times. And they were all talking about how this guy was captured and how the cops were so heroic. And there was even an article in the Daily News about how heroic Terrence Howell was, that he was able to subdue this guy and he didn't even have to unholster his gun. It was the tale of two cities in terms of articles, because if you read the paper on Sunday and then you read the paper on Monday, well, there were two totally different versions of what happened.
Not only were the news outlets saying Howard and Taylor, but mostly Howard, apprehended Gelman alone, but that off-duty detective, Marcello Razzo, was also present and assisted in the arrest.
And who is Razzo?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I always say Marcello Razzo, they must have owed him one, because when I saw his picture, I said, can I curse? Did we talk about this already?
Yeah, I mean, you already have, and it's fine.
Okay. So I saw his picture and I said, well, that motherfucker wasn't on the train. I said, he was not on the train. I said, the next time I'm on a train with Marcello Razzo will be the first time I'm on the train with Marcello Razzo. So I don't exactly know what's happening there, because Alfred Douglas was the one who helped apprehend him.
Joe was released from the hospital on Sunday and jumped right into an onslaught of interviews. He also was going to testify to the grand jury the following Thursday, less than a week after the assault.
It's going to be me and Howell and Tamara Taylor. We're going to all testify. I'm going to go first. And we go in and I'm basically sitting in front of, I don't know, it may as well have been a million people. I don't remember how many people were there. It was a lot of people. And the ADA's name was Lynn, and ADA Lynn, he's just asking me questions and I'm answering him. And I believe there were times I probably got emotional. And I remember that they started passing the pictures around. They had taken photos of me before they stitched me up and stapled me, which I'd never seen before and have never been made public, thankfully. I would hate for those pictures to ever be made public, because they're pretty dramatic and they would probably, they're disturbing. And like I said, the one picture, you could see my skull.
Joe watched as the jury could barely make themselves look at the photos.
I was there, I don't know how long it was. It wasn't very long. I mean, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe, if that long. So I'm done and I go out and I sit down, and then who is sitting next to me but Tamara Taylor? And she looked really uneasy. I don't know what she said to me, like, how was it, whatever. I said, I was fine, you know, just, basically giving my recollection of the day. And okay. And then I go, hey, I remember when you called me likely. And she just looked at me and said, you remember that? And I said, yeah, I remember everything. I said, I remember everything. And that was it. Completely shut down. And then I got the text from my sister, all right, we're outside. And I got up, I'm like, all right, have a good day. And that was it.
Maxim Gelman ended up pleading guilty to the murders and assaulting Joe. So there was no trial.
The crime against me was committed in Manhattan. Everything else that he did, the four murders and the two or three assaults, that all happened in Brooklyn. So he was going to be sentenced in Brooklyn before the Manhattan one. And I remember reading the papers the next day after that in Brooklyn, and he was just as big a piece of shit as he possibly could be. He was, very disrespectful to the victims' families.
In all, Gelman was sentenced to 200 years for the Brooklyn murders, assaults, and robberies. He was unremorseful and at one point shouted at the victims' families. Though his sentence for the Brooklyn crimes assured that Gelman was never getting out of prison, he still needed to be sentenced for attacking Joe. Joe read a victim impact statement at Gelman's sentencing and was fired up after reading about Gelman's behavior in Brooklyn court.
I'm not grateful that he was an asshole to them, but I'm grateful that I read the article because then I knew what to expect. So then it was sort of like, well, I know I'm smarter than him. I know I'm more clever than he is. So let's do the war of words. Because I knew the minute I said something, he was going to try to come back with something. But so I said what I said. He said what he said. And we were going back and forth. And I started feeling my adrenaline. And I could feel like you kind of get like the interior shakes. And it's not nerves. It's I have to control myself. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I kind of shut it down. And I said, all right, I'm done.
Because you might do something violent.
Because I want, and again, intellectually, I know I can't do anything, but the body's going to react. The mind is going to cause the body to react a certain way. And I knew there was no chance I would get to him. And that's when I shut it down. And then I sat down and he made a stupid comment about Kim Kardashian.
Gelman actually proposed to Kim Kardashian, who was not present.
It was fun. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was fun to be there again. You know, I'm sure some people wouldn't look at it that way, but I had the opportunity to basically tell him what a coward he was. You know, you get the opportunity to say what you want to say to someone. Obviously, I wish it was just, you know, a locked room with no windows, but I didn't have that option. So you work within the parameters you're given. I would do it once a week if I could. Absolutely. Hmm. Yeah, I would do it. I'd do it once a week if I could go in there and basically belittle him 100%.
Gelman was sentenced to 25 years for assaulting Joe to be served consecutively to the sentence for the murders. Gelman's sentencing was about a year after his arrest. While Gelman waited out that year in Rikers, Joe was recovering from the attack as quickly as he could. His work had told him to take all the time he needed, but Joe was itching to get back to normal, so he decided to go back 3 weeks after the attack.
And I remember my boss calling me, and my boss, he's not just the boss, he's a friend. He's one of the nicest people I've ever met. And he goes, I'm going to meet you at Penn Station and take the train with you to the job. So he goes, just tell me what time you get to Penn Station. And I'm going to take the subway with you. And I was like, God, you don't have to do that. You know, you don't, you know, he's like, no, I'm doing it. So the first day back, he met me at Penn Station and we were just laughing about it pretty much the whole time. Like Pete's like, I don't know what I'm going to do if a guy comes at us with a knife, you know, he goes, I just want to be here to support you. And I was like, that's great. And again, I work in a box office. I'm not building houses or anything. So it's not, I wouldn't call it manual labor. Probably about halfway through the day, I was just out of gas. And he saw it. Like, I didn't ask. He's like, you got to go home.
Hmm.
And I was like, I don't know. Maybe I came back too soon. And then I came back the following week. So I think all told, I was out for a month.
Were you being paid while you were out?
Yes. Obviously, it was a big story. You know, it was a global story, but especially so in New York City. So I doubt it was much of a decision. They didn't have to pay me. They didn't have to, but they did. And I'm grateful for that. I'll always be grateful for that.
By this point, Joe had told his story to many news outlets, but the city's version of events hadn't really changed. Joe was Gelman's last victim, and the two police officers were the ones that stopped him. There wasn't much Joe could do about that. But one day, shortly after Joe returned to work, he was approached at the Lincoln Center fountain by someone with some pretty damning information.
I'm just kind of walking around the fountain talking to a buddy of mine. And I notice that there's someone following me. And I just start laughing. Like at this point, nothing fazes me anymore, right? So I'm on the phone. I go, you're not going to believe this. And he goes, what? I'm like, there's someone following me. And he's like, come on. I'm like, dude, I'm walking in a circle. There's someone following me. So I go, let me call you back. So I slow up my pace to the point where he gets close to me, and I turn around and I'm just like, can I help you? And he was startled. He's like, oh, you know, no, I'm not looking for any trouble. I'm not looking for any trouble. He goes, I was on the grand jury that you testified in front of. And I said, well, how do I know that? I said, I don't know. You know, you could be lying. I go, how do I know that? He goes, all right. I know the pictures that they showed us were very graphic. And basically whatever he said was, I knew he wasn't lying because those were never made public. And he said, when Terrence Howell testified, he testified that when you and Gelman had first started, he was going to come out, but he thought Gelman had a gun, so he stayed inside. So it took me a second, and I'm like, so wait, he testified that he was going to come out and do something, but he thought that the other guy had a gun, so he went back inside to the locked room and left a train full of unarmed passengers to deal with this guy. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, when he said that, we're just kind of like looking at each other. Like, he goes, it hit us all at once. Like, did he really just say that? He said after he was done testifying and he left the room, he goes, basically the jury, the grand jury kind of surrounded the ADA and said, can we bring him up on charges? He goes, basically he goes, this is what our tax dollars are paying for. He goes, he just admitted to leaving a train full of unarmed civilians with a spree killer. And the ADA is like, no, that's not what we're here for. It's not what we're here. We got to stay focused on the task at hand, right? Part of me was happy that I finally had the confirmation. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it was like being attacked all over again.
Yeah.
That's when we decided that we had to do something. So.
That something was to sue the New York Police Department. The city filed to dismiss immediately. The lawyer Joe had been working with didn't have much hope they would win and decided not to move forward with the case. So Joe took it on himself and wrote a response to the dismissal.
I have my computer and I have Google. Before I would go to work in the morning, I would be on there working on it. When I would come home from work, I'd be on the computer working on it. On my days off, it was nonstop. So I'm literally looking up hundreds and because their whole dismissal thing was full of fluff. It was, they had cases in there about broken fences. They had cases in there about exotic cars. There was office furniture case, like absolute garbage.
So Joe writes up this whole document describing how all the cases the city cited weren't relevant to what happened to him.
And I had sent the file to Ed,
the lawyer not working on the case.
Because he's like, when you're done, send it to me. I want to read it over. Mm-hmm. He basically said, he goes, I'll be honest with you. This is probably as good as anyone could do that is not a lawyer, as far as what I've read, which meant a lot to me because he could have said, it's a piece of shit.
So Joe submitted the document to the court.
And I wait and I pray that they don't dismiss the case. And I don't know how many weeks later it was. I'm at work and my phone rings and it's Ed. And he's like, I just wanted to say, I don't know if you know, but I'm really sorry they still dismissed the case. And there were a lot of tears, you know, we were very upset because I wanted my opportunity. And the thing that I always said was, if I'm allowed to go to court and I lose, I won't like it, but I'll accept it because then the process was true to itself. Mm-hmm. I was allowed to do what I had to do. And whether it was a jury or the judge, hey, you win nothing, you lose, you win a dollar. At least the process happened. And when I read her dismissal, it was 2.5 pages. She basically, for 2.5 pages, agreed with what I said. Said my recollection rings true and is very credible. But based on precedent, she could not dismiss the case.
There is a really great episode of Radiolab called No Special Duty that explains all the legal nitty-gritty really well. But to summarize here, the police have no constitutional duty to protect citizens unless a special relationship is formed. In this case, that means that the police would have had knowledge that Joe was in danger, which it seems like they did. Joe would have had to ask the police for help, which he did not. The police would have had to agree to help him, which they did not. And Joe would have had to act differently, believing the police would step in. Otherwise, they have no special duty to intervene.
It's a hard lesson that I learned. When cases were brought against them, like mine, it's the first thing people would say. It's on your cars to protect and serve. It's on your cars. Well, I guess after hearing that enough, they've actually changed it. It's not on their cars anymore. The cars now say courtesy, professionalism, and respect.
I would be so angry all the time. How do you kind of deal with that?
I am. You know, I'm angry when I have to be. But I think if I let it consume me, then that could get dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could get dangerous for me or the people I love or people I don't love. I think that could snowball very easily, but it's nothing I really have to work at. And I've actually, for someone who doesn't really focus on it, I've actually had people say, why don't you get over it? And I'm like, well, I don't really do anything. Like I post my tweets every morning, but that's sort of just like my routine, but I don't dwell on it. But I guess it's just how you view things.
While Joe found the cops on the train that day lacking, to say the least, he still has respect for the profession.
I think if you're in a line of work where you don't know if you're coming home that night, I think there's a certain amount of reverence that I think should be paid to you. Now, that's just the way I was raised. I've always been one that has taken people individually. There are bad people in every line of work. You would hope in a line of work like law enforcement that it would be, the percentage would be low. But it's like any other line of work. We're all human. And I was unfortunate enough to be on the train that day with two cowardly pieces of shit. And let me go one step further. I think when a cop does something heroic, that guy should be across, or lady, should be across all the newspapers and on the news. But conversely, when they drop the ball, they've got to be called to the carpet.
And given all that Joe has gone through, his life today is just about the same as it was before the attack.
What is it, 4:35 right now? It's Sunday. In about 90 minutes, I'm going to throw some stuff on the grill, you know, like a typical Long Island dad, and have a beer or two. And that's pretty much, that's it.
Is there anything I missed? Anything you want to make sure is in there that we didn't talk about?
Well, if you don't mind, can I tell people about my podcast?
Oh, yes,
please. Since we're not in direct competition with each other.
Sure.
Hockey's a big part of our lives. And it's been a big part of my life forever. And I have my own podcast. It's about hockey fighting. So what I do is I interview fighters, guys who fight in hockey, because I think it's the most noble role. They don't really fight anymore. The game's sort of gotten a little soft. But I try to interview guys that did the job. I think it's the most selfless job. You're literally putting your life on the line for your teammates, for your brothers. And I feel like these guys should be acknowledged. Well, Coliseum Chronicles, the penalty box. If you're interested in hearing some really good stories from the guys who've battled, definitely check it out. It's on all the platforms. And, you know, download, don't stream. Download. I'm part of the Hockey Podcast Network, so every time you download, I get a few more pennies there.
You can find Coliseum Chronicles, The Penalty Box, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.